Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday already, the 5th of November. We're going to talk about cars the first hour of the program today and look at the news that Ford Motor Company improved its sales and earned $1 billion in the third quarter. It made money in North America for the first time since 2005. News reports say that it did this because it turned itself around by cutting costs and introducing cars that consumers want to buy, rather than resorting to deep discounts to lure shoppers into showrooms. If you watch television, you know that GM is marketing a 60-day money-back guarantee. Do people turn their cars back after 60 days? It seems to me as though that would be fairly strange. This, again, according to reports, will result in market share gains for GM. We'll look at consumer reports and the fact that a new report has come out showing that Honda and Toyota continue to have the most reliable vehicles, but actually Ford is very close behind. What's happened to all that money we gave car makers to spiff up their products and get them to make cars that we like? We'll talk about that. And it should be an interesting hour because I know you like to talk about cars. Actually, I do too. I kind of like cars. I could tell you this, but I've been driving. My husband had to get a new car because there was an accident. And so he's in New York at the World Series, and I've been driving his car all over the place. I mean, we're talking Iowa to look at colleges. We're talking every day to work, and I think he's coming home today. So my pleasure is short-lived. No, I mean, I'm happy to have him home, but the car will be gone, you know. And you'll wonder, where did all those miles come from? Our guest this hour is David Zoya. He's editorial director of WardsAuto.com, Ward's Automotive Reports, and Ward's Engine and Vehicle Technology Update. Our phone number, when we talk about cars, I know, most of us drive them, so we just get lots of phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Hi, David. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Ford, that they earned $1 billion, made money for the first time since 2005. That's a long time.
It's definitely good news here in the Detroit area. We've had nothing but gloom over the past year and a half or so. So to see one of these auto companies finally land in the black is a cause for celebration around here.
And how did they do it?
Well, you know, I think they're all have gone through some serious restructuring in terms of cutting costs, taking their capacity down, really leaving no stone unturned in terms of trying to eliminate unnecessary spending. They've been able to reduce their incentive costs quite a bit. And, you know, they're really doing it with products that people want to buy. The encouraging thing we've seen in the last few months of sales is some of the newer products from both GM and Ford really are doing well in the marketplace. So it's a sign that they're getting their design act together and really starting to put some vehicles out there that are a good value proposition for consumers.
And what cars is Ford making that we're attracted to?
Well, it's things like cross-utility vehicles are a hot segment. So things like the Ford Escape and the Ford Edge are popular. And then in the mid-size cars are coming back. So Ford has done well with, like, the Fusion has been very popular. The Focus has been up and down a bit depending on where gas prices stand. But it's vehicles like that are driving the market for Ford.
Mid-size cars rather than compact cars. How's the mileage on those mid-size cars?
You know, getting better. You can get into the 20s with some of them. In the case of the Fusion, Ford offers a hybrid now, and that can get up into the 30 plus mile per gallon range, depending on how you drive. So the vehicles out there are getting much more fuel efficient. We're seeing that with GM with the Chevy Equinox, for instance. That's a mid-size SUV or CUV actually that gets into the mid-20s. So these are pretty good miles per gallon figures, based on industry averages.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the hybrid cars that get much higher mileage than what you just talked about? Are those out of fashion right now? Were they just a fad, or people buy them? They do cost more money because they're concerned about the environment and a lot of people just can't afford the price tag. How are they doing?
Yeah, they are expensive, and the demand very much goes up and down depending on where gas prices are. So last year when we were touching $4 a gallon for gas, we saw hybrid sales really spike. And then when things went back down, closer to $2-$2.50 per gallon, the demand starts to wane a little bit. So it's a very sensitive to how people are feeling about gas prices. But, by and large, you're seeing more of those coming to the market, and, we expect volumes to go up. Nobody thinks gas prices won't continue to go up overall, although we'll see, spikes and dips over time. But the trend is definitely to higher gas prices, and I think more and more of these vehicles will be out there, and the cost will start to come down.
What about the workforce? Did Ford cut benefits substantially for the workforce now that they're making more money? Are they going to have workers say we should get a share of that?
Well, the case of Ford in particular, they did get some concessions a year or so ago ahead of, as this economic crisis was just getting underway, really. But they went back to the union in the past month for additional concessions, which were just voted down over the past weekend. And what Ford was trying to do was to get their labor contract on a par with what Chrysler and GM were able to do as they headed into bankruptcy. And in this case, the workers turned it down. So this was the first time in the last couple of years where workers have, despite everything, said enough is enough. We're not going to go for more concessions.
And is that going to hurt Ford, do you think, in terms of sales in the next year?
It probably won't in terms of sales. I mean, it does put them at a little bit of a cost disadvantage against the other two domestic automakers. So, from that sense, it makes them a little less competitive. But The gaps between the two contracts aren't huge, so it probably won't have a serious effect on their financials. But it could cause Ford to, say, maybe make some sourcing decisions differently. They may go outsource some business that they would have built inside their own plants just to save costs.
Mm-hmm. Outsourcing to where?
Well, to suppliers, perhaps, or possibly even other regions, that kind of thing, where they'll have to, it makes the UAW plants a little less cost competitive, and it's possible that it could drive Ford to look for alternative sources.
What's with this ad that GM is running? I wonder if it has been successful for them, that if you don't like your car, your new car you get, you got a 60-day money-back guarantee. How can you tell in 60 days with a car whether or not you're going to like it or not?
Yeah, I think, very few people are going to return their car. In the initial, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, GM had said that only one person so far had decided to return their car, and it was a case of a Corvette buyer who had bought a manual transmission and decided he didn't like it, and he came back and they swapped it for an automatic. And the reality is most buyers aren't even taking the plan. They're opting for the $500 discount instead of that. But the idea behind it was to try to change this perception that GM is making inferior vehicles, lower quality vehicles. So what they're trying to do is basically challenge the consumer to say, we're willing to give you your money back if you don't like it. That's how confident we are in the car. And they seem to think that it is drawing more people to the showroom, and they've actually extended the program. So it's a sign that they think it must be working for them a bit.
Mm-hmm. And, Dave, what's happening with Chrysler? Is it falling off the map?
Well, we just sat through an exhaustive 8-hour backgrounder yesterday, in fact, on where Chrysler is going in the next 5 years. And you know, at the moment, it's fallen off the map because they've been very quiet while they designed this game plan that they detailed yesterday. And they don't have a lot of new products, so that we're seeing their sales go down dramatically, their market share slipping. But in the game plan that they revealed yesterday, they do have a pretty solid outlook, and they do have new models coming thanks to their collaboration with Fiat. And, you know, they do expect to make a profit as early as 2011 and pay back these loans by 2014. So if they're able to put some vehicles out there that people want to buy, you know, they do have a roadmap to recovery.
Mm-hmm. What did you do for 8 hours? That's a long time.
Oh, my gosh.
Time.
It was it was exhausted. But they explained everything from, you know, brand positioning to future vehicles to platform and powertrain sharing with Fiat and all the financial metrics of how they're going to get from where they are today to where they expect to be in 2014. So it was quite detailed. But like I said, it was an impressive performance. I think it does show that the culture has changed there dramatically, and they really do seem inspired to try and engineer this turnaround.
Did you get to drive any of the cars?
No, they didn't really show us anything. A couple of flashes in slides, but we haven't seen any of the products yet. And most of them, most of the real significant stuff won't really start to roll out until about 2011. Hmm. So, you know, they have to get to that point, really. They have to survive the next maybe 18 months until we start to see many of these new products. But, you know, they seem to be in a position to be able to do that.
And tell me how much money we gave GM and Chrysler. I forgot. And have we recouped any of that money?
It's you know, in the tens of billions between the two of them, and no, there's definitely been no payback this early, and it's you know, doubtful even in the case, particularly in the case of GM, I think, whether that money will ever come back fully. Like I said, Chrysler plans on paying back the loans by 2014, but the GM money is going to have to come from when they issue a stock offering. And, you know, the question of whether GM will ever be worth that kind of value is questionable.
Consumer Reports came up last week with their annual car reliability survey. I'd like for you to explain more what it means to be a reliable car. And it's going to be published in December. Honda and Toyota continue to have, according to this report, the most reliable vehicles. But Ford, they say, very close behind.
Yeah, Ford has been moving up in their charts and in a number of others over the last couple of years, and many of their cars are now considered good picks by them. So that's a good sign for Ford. They really are probably on a par now with the Japanese in terms of quality. The other two guys trailing a bit, GM a little better than Chrysler, and you're seeing with their newer models are more successful than, obviously, their older ones. So there's an indication, at least, that they're headed in the right direction. And, you know, Chrysler talked about that yesterday. They know where they stand, and they know they have to get it fixed. And, you know, we won't really see that until some of these new products roll out. But, you know, it's definitely in everybody's target. And, you know, we're seeing some evidence that the Detroit guys are moving up a bit. And I think the other thing is that the gaps are, even where they exist, are much smaller than they used to be. And, you know, you're talking about less significant quality issues. You know, we're not talking about cars that are left dead on the road anymore. You know, you're looking more at maybe some trim out of place, or people just don't think the mileage is high enough, or, you know, issues like that, less about real serious engine or transmission failures, things like that.
Right. And what about that massive recall that Toyota has concerning the floor mats, or they think maybe it may be more than the floor mats now? Is that hurting them?
I don't think it has yet, but I think as the publicity continues to mount, it does have that possibility. You know, Toyota in recent years has had some quality issues, and they've as they've grown and their capacity has increased and their model lineup has broadened, we've seen some issues with their quality, and their new CEO has vowed to address that, and it's, you know, it's the first signs really of tarnish in the Toyota brand name, and I think this recall has really the potential to damage, you know, more than ever. We saw that with a similar situation with Audi in the late 80s that nearly had Audi having to leave the U.S. market because of these similar types of allegations. So the publicity could be very bad, even if Toyota is proven to be correct and it's just a floor mat issue and they fix it, you know, you have all this negative publicity leading up to that could damage the brand.
And what does it mean? What all is involved, Dave, in a reliability survey? Is it how long a car lasts or what the mileage is? What is it?
It kind of depends on who's doing the survey, but usually it's a pretty exhaustive set of criteria of just trying to gauge how customers, whether they're happy with their car, whether they've had any mechanical issues. So, like I said, in some of the cases, a quality issue could be simply, I thought I was going to get higher gas mileage. Or it could be, there was uneven trim on the interior, or, you know, I had to take it back for a minor repair. Anything that would lead the consumer to be somewhat unsatisfied with the vehicle, whether it's just, you know, a frequent repair issue that they've had to hassle with, or the vehicle just maybe doesn't drive the way they thought it would.
Mm-hmm. How long do we keep our cars now? What's the average?
I think it's around 7 years on the road. But, of course, a lot of people turn them over, you know, much more frequently. But that probably is lessening now that we're seeing the industry back away from leasing quite a bit, where, they were leasing these cars at 24 months and 30 and 36 months, and people were turning them in more frequently. The leasing business has kind of dried up quite a bit with this recession, and, you know, we may start to see people keeping their cars a little bit longer.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Dave, and we'll start them in a moment. Dave Zoya is our guest, editorial director of WardsAuto.com, Ward's Automotive Reports, and Ward's Engine and Vehicle Technology Update. It's been a while since we looked at what's going on in the car industry. We gave them a lot of money, taxpayer money, to turn things around. So we're looking at that. We're looking at what's happening with Ford. News this week that they made close to $1 billion during the third quarter, and they haven't made money since 2005. So that's big news. Advertising strategies for GM, Chrysler not really able to turn things around very quickly. Reliability reports from Consumer Reports showing Toyota and Honda are thought to be the most reliable vehicles now, but things may be changing. Is that a good thing? Our number, we have one line open, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second of our program today, we're happy to have Sylvia Earle with us. Her latest book is The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. She is the National Geographic Explorer in Residence, has been called Her Deepness by The New Yorker and The New York Times, and a living legend by the Library of Congress. She has explored the oceans, has a lot to say about what resources we have depleted and how we need to pay a whole lot more attention to the oceans, which keep us alive. So she'll be with us, hour number two. All right, phone calls for Dave. We start with Tom from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I had a comment. I'm kind of a closet motorhead, and I recently was in a junkyard just looking for parts and pieces, and I noticed this incredible amount of what I interpreted as perfectly good cars. And as I started looking them over, they all had these stickers on the engines that said this car has been destroyed as a result of cash for clunkers. And I was just appalled at the appearance. I mean, these were what appeared to be perfectly functional. They're not rusted. They're not dented up. They're not beat up. They have, you know, immaculate interiors, and they would take brake shavings, filings, metal filings, and pour them down the crankcase until the engine blew up. And, you know, this whole idea of the cash for clunkers was just a shock to me. I mean, I assumed that these were cars that were dragged in and this kind of thing, but these were clearly valuable vehicles that were destroyed. And it just seems so contradictory to the efforts that we're trying to put forth in, you know, the environment and all this kind of stuff. And I just wondered what kind of comments the guests might have about that.
Well, you know, I agree with you in the sense I tend to keep my cars for 10 or 12 years, too. So it's hard to see cars that are drivable being destroyed. You kind of wonder, you know, shouldn't we be trying to get what we can out of those as much as we can? So it is, you know, it was sad to see a lot of cars that, you know, some of us would drive being destroyed. Maybe unnecessarily, but I think the rationale behind it from an environmental sense was, you know, that they had to be traded in on vehicles that were going to get better fuel economy, and you know, from a strictly economic sense, it was trying to spur some demand in the automobile industry and keep some people working. So, you know, it did that, I think. The environmental impact is probably pretty slight when you add it all up, but at least from the view here in Detroit, it did help spur some sales, and it did help keep this industry rolling for a couple of months.
Would you say that it was very big for the industry, or it just spurred moderate sales?
It did very well in the time that it ran. It really spiked sales up way beyond where they had been running. Now, since then, it's settled back down to the rates that we saw earlier in the year, but it did help clear out a lot of inventory and allow these plants to get back to running at normal speed. So from that standpoint, it has helped greatly, and it's probably put a little bit of momentum back into the market.
Thank you, Tom, for your call. Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen, and to your guest. I'm driving a 1990 Plymouth Horizon with a 5-speed standard. It's small, it's compact, very little rust on it, and I think that was the last year they built those. But out on the highway, out on the interstate, I get a little over 37 miles a gallon.
Really?
Now, but my question is, also it's got a 2.2 engine in it, and before that I had a Sundance I drove for 8 years. But this thing, you know, very little rust, and it runs just great out on the road. Now, why did they quit making those? That's the first question. Next one is, are there any of those small cars like that around anymore?
Well, yeah, there's still you know, some decent small cars out there. You know, things like the Honda Fit and the Toyota Yaris are a Honda Civic, I believe you can get into the 35 mile per gallon range. You've got the Ford Focus out there. So there are a lot of cars out there like that, and I think you're going to see more. I mean, there is a movement to smaller vehicles and definitely more fuel-efficient vehicles, because we do have this higher fuel economy target that we have to hit in 2016. So everybody's focused on smaller engines and smaller vehicles and lighter-weight cars.
We're so weird, aren't we? First we're focused on it, and then we're not focused on it. He's driving a 1990 Plymouth and getting 38 miles a gallon, and we're touting, well, 20s is pretty good. The Honda Civics are getting 35 maybe, and he's got a car that's pretty old that's doing better.
Yeah, you know, I think that kind of highlights the market that these automakers face. We have relatively cheap gasoline, and it goes up and down, and we haven't had a real policy, I think an energy policy, that would promote more fuel-efficient vehicles over the long term. So we've seen, you know, pockets of the market that are interested in fuel economy and a whole other people that aren't, and we've seen eras and time periods where fuel efficiency is a big concern by buyers, and they all flock to smaller cars. And then we see periods where, you know, giant SUVs are the thing. So that's the dilemma I think that the industry has faced over the years, and it gets portrayed as being anti-fuel economy. But I think really the struggle that they have as manufacturers is, you know, what are people going to want 3 or 4 years from now? Is fuel efficiency going to be the thing, or isn't it? And so, you know, they struggle with that, and they have to try to project what's going to happen. And we see, you know, these trends that come and go that are very costly to the industry. So,
right.
But now I think they're firmly, you know, bought into the fuel economy model, and I think you'll see that being stressed over the next, you know, 5-10 years.
Do you think they have played a large role in determining rather what we want rather than we're letting them know what we want?
Yeah, you know, that's a factor too. The fact that they built these SUVs and these V8 engines and then incentivized people to buy them, you know, was a big factor. You could get a pretty nice discount on a SUV when the market was slow. So that drove some of the sales as well. But I think really it's a combination of all that. It's consumers fluctuating in their choice, the lack of a real energy policy and a focused direction from the government, and, you know, the industry itself kind of pushing people in certain directions.
Thanks, Eugene. We go to Scott from Westfield next. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Got a question. GM's reversal on their the sale of Opel and how it's kind of enraged the Germans. I'm almost seeing that as GM got past this bankruptcy and are now, instead of downsizing like they talked like they would, now they're going, well, maybe we won't get rid of and shed off all these other companies. And you think they're going to go back to their ways of being an oversized car company? And this is maybe just one of the signs that now that they're past the trouble, that they're going to revert back?
Well, I hope they don't go back. I don't think it's necessarily a sign of that. I think the reality was GM never really wanted to sell Opel because it does play a real critical role for them in terms of engineering on engines, particularly small engines and diesel engines and mid-size and small vehicle platforms. So it's a very strategic piece from an engineering standpoint for the company. And their hand was forced as they were headed into bankruptcy and bailouts to separate that business off because the federal government didn't want U.S. dollars going to support foreign operations. So they had to break it off, and the German government was only going to give them money if they sold the operation. And so they were kind of trapped in a corner. And then what's happened more recently was, as the European Union began to look at the deal, it kind of forced Germany into saying it'll provide that aid to whoever runs Opel. And I think that gave GM the opportunity to say, well, we'll take it back then, and we'll be the guy running it. So I think, you know, it does put them back where they are. There's still some problems with it. Opel's been a money loser for them for you know, over a decade, and they have to rationalize some of that capacity and cut costs over there. But to get rid of it, and to, you know, even if holding a minority stake would have put their whole global engineering piece at risk, because they would have had to rely on a outside partner for a lot of the core technology they expect to have down the road.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the thought. It seemed like it was such a quick reversal, and there was such backlash that I didn't know if there was going to be any, you know, repercussions, you know, from Germany. Because it sounded like they were, I mean, livid about it.
Yeah, I think there is that. I think there's a big morale issue and a big cultural problem that GM is going to have to face, because the workers there, and even the management there, was, I think, very happy with the thought that GM was going to be out of the picture, and now they're back. So GM has to mend a lot of fences, I think, with its workers, and it's going to have to do that at a time where it's slashing jobs quite heavily, and so it's going to be a challenge to them to make that operation profitable. And you know, in some ways, in the long run, they'd be better off without it. But the problem is that core engineering that they would have had a hard time shifting away from there in a short period.
How much time does GM and Chrysler have to show us that they've done good things and they've really turned their companies around after we gave them a lot of money?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're going to have to see some progress almost on a quarterly basis. And, you know, that doesn't mean that either one of them is going to be in the black anytime soon. But what you want to see is things like their market share at least holding ground or possibly increasing. You know, that they're starting to, instead of burn through cash, starting to come through a quarter with a surplus in cash. You know, that was one of the things about the Ford quarterly report the other day that was encouraging, was, you know, they were no longer spending money at the rate, you know, they were coming through with plus cash, whereas last year in the height of this downturn, these companies were spending $1 billion a month just to keep going. So it was $1 billion every month that was going out the door. So that's the kind of thing you have to start to see a turnaround on, that they're actually making revenue instead of spending it. And so there'll be little milestones like that you'll have to watch for to see that they're headed in the right direction.
Thanks, Scott. Chris is next from Watertown. Hi, Chris.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You bring up the engineering arm that Opel has brought for GM, and it ties right into my question, is why the U.S. manufacturers can't be more responsive to bringing us diesel vehicles like Volkswagen has. I'm driving a 1996 VW with a diesel that I get. It's got 330,000 miles on it, and I'm still getting 50 miles to the gallon with it. Volkswagen's been doing this for a long time, and so have our American manufacturers, GM and Ford overseas, but yet not over here.
Yeah, you know, the diesels are great. The modern diesels, they're quiet, they're smooth, they get a tremendous fuel economy. And believe it or not, I think all the auto companies are interested in bringing them over. The problem right now is that with gas prices and diesel prices both low, that the amount of extra that people have to put out for those engines, it's hard to make that cost up back in the fuel that you're saving. So the business proposition isn't as clear as they would like it to be. And there's also emissions regulations that are murky in some cases, or that some of these engines have trouble meeting without very expensive exhaust after treatment systems. So there's a huge cost penalty. There's some emissions uncertainty out there, and they've all got the engines, and they're willing to do that, but they want to see that there is indeed a market out there for it.
Well, I understand, you know, and I was expecting it, some of your replies, but for goodness sakes, if Volkswagen has been able to do this for so many years, and most of these companies have been able to pursue this overseas, I mean, I just don't. It, to me, it doesn't make sense. And I know you're right. They do have the engines available. I see that Ford has this new van out that's called the Transport that's, I believe, being marketed globally. And, of course, it's available with a diesel engine overseas, and yet the best, they just don't have it here in the United States when it's, it wouldn't even be an engineering feat to bring it in.
Yeah, you know, and it's really, you know, a lot of it's related to the price of diesel, the tax incentives that are out there in Europe that have pushed people towards diesel engines. Yeah, and some companies have been bringing them here. You know, you're seeing Mercedes with them and BMW, and like you said, Volkswagen's the only one really with a low-cost vehicle that has a diesel engine. So, you know, you're starting to see it. More of them want to bring them in, and I think you'll start to see that happening. But, you know, for a lot of these companies, they're a little concerned that whereas Volkswagen has cultivated this audience, you know, GM hasn't or Ford hasn't. And so I think they're a little reticent to put that investment in there and then find out there isn't demand. But I think you will see some of that coming and more car companies offering diesels over the next, you know, 2 or 3 years.
Thanks, Chris. Terry, Sturgeon Bay, hi.
Hi, good morning. One of the things that I think is lent to Ford's resurgence is the fact that the government did bail out the other two. And you may not have heard it here, but I listen to a lot of radio, and I have heard a backlash from people that have been discussing the bailouts to the point where there's so much resentment in the fact that nobody believes that we would, you know, nobody has ever believed we would ever see this money again. And now it appears as though that's going to be the case. There doesn't appear to be any accountability for where this money came from or went. It's kind of easy come, easy go. Nobody's going to get their hands slapped for just simply, you know, giving these companies billions and billions of dollars. And largely what happened as a result, too, was that so much of this went to the unions. The ownership of the company transferred to the unions, and I'd be willing to bet that if there ever was any accountability, if anybody looked into this, you would find that the union pension funds are doing better than ever now, because that was one of the big deals behind this, was to try to buoy those pension funds. They've been hurting for a long time. The other thing, though, is that there is a direct backlash from consumers that are just saying, you know what, I'm not going to buy a Chrysler. I'm not going to buy a GM product. In fact, GM is now labeled government motors in many sectors, and particularly in the fleet sectors, they're taking a real hit. I heard a programmer, two fleet managers called in and said, we've been directed to just buy nothing but Fords in the future. We're not buying anything from Chrysler. We're not buying anything from GM. So I think that really has to be brought up as a stark reality in this situation. We can dance around all kinds of different issues, but the bottom line is that you know, the public is not stupid, and the public is certainly deserving of some outrage in this case, and I think they're expressing it by going to Ford.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, Ford has played that up. In fact, you know, that they didn't take the loans. They've tried to use that as a way to distance themselves from the other two here in Detroit, and to say that they're different and that, you know, they were more forward thinking, and they also have had the good press about the quality of their vehicles, and you know, there's a certain momentum in the fact that their sales have held up better than the other guys through this stretch. So, you know, there's some momentum in that they appear to be the healthier company and the one that a lot of consumers then would be more comfortable with buying their vehicles. You know, some of the reason to stay away from GM or Chrysler is simply, you know, are these companies going to still be in business, and am I going to buy a car that, you know, I won't be able to get service or warranty work on? And I think, you know, you're right, too. There are some people out there that are not happy with the bailout and simply will stay away from those companies. So those are all the hurdles that these two have to get over as they try to recover. They have to, you know, the changing buyer perception is probably, you know, the biggest factor that they have to overcome. They've got to convince people that they're worth another look, and that's a hard thing to do.
Thanks so much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Dave Zoya is our guest, and we're talking cars this hour with the news from Ford that they made money, about $1 billion last quarter, first time since 2005 that's happened. What's happened with our taxpayer money to bail out GM and Chrysler? What are you doing in terms of your car buying habits? Are you switching more to American-made cars to help the U.S. economy? Consumer Reports publishing in December showing that Toyota and Honda are still considered the most reliable cars. And that's all that we're talking about, and then some. 800-486-8655, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Thursday, Sylvia Earle will be joining us, National Geographic Explorer in Residence. Her latest book, The World is Blue, How Our Fate and the Oceans Are One. Returning to phone calls now, we go to Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
No, I think you've got Matt in Lake Geneva.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi, Matt.
Oh, hello. I had heard that Subaru did really well this year. Their second quarter was one of the best they had on record, I guess, while American automakers were languishing. And I noticed that Subaru's always pretty high up near the top in Consumers Reports ratings. Can you confirm any of this stuff for me?
Yeah, Subaru's done very well. They are one of the companies that have bucked the downturn here in the U.S. I'm just looking right now. Their numbers, you know, they're up on a calendar year basis, like almost 13% in their sales. So that's in a market that's down 25%. So they've done quite well. They have done well on the reliability ratings, and they're often the darling of the buff books when they rate their cars. So the car and drivers and road and track seem to like Subarus an awful lot. So
they don't advertise very much, do they?
No, they don't, and they're a small volume company. So that 12% isn't a huge amount of vehicles, but they have a real niche in certain areas of the country and with certain types of buyers, and their all wheel drive kind of branding has always been strong through the last couple of decades, really, and they just have that niche that they serve very well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Randy from Mercer is next. Hi, Randy.
Hello. I've been listening to a couple of your comments about the high mileage per gallon cars. I'm driving a 90, well, today actually I'm driving a 97 Geo Metro, which I get 45 miles a gallon.
Great.
But I have a 93 Geo Metro that I get 50 to 51 miles a gallon with. And I had a 1980 Dodge Colt that I get 54 miles a gallon with. And you talk about the diesels. My parents had a 1980 Buick that was a diesel. It was an awful diesel. They put the diesel engine in a gas-designed engine, and it didn't work very well. But they did have diesels over here, and I don't understand why they can, 35 miles a gallon versus 50 is a substantial difference. I don't know why they can't make cars here that, and people realize they're going to have $4 and $5 and $6 gas relatively soon, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you point up a couple of good points. One is those diesels weren't very good, and I think that's what set this market back. You know, the people back in that era that bought diesels were not very happy with them. They weren't very good. They didn't run well. They had mechanical problems, and it really destroyed the market for diesels here for a long time. And I think that's what the industry in part is trying to overcome now, and the new generation diesels are amazing, and they will win buyers over if you can get them into them, and that's the tough part. You know, the other issue you're bringing up with the high mileage of cars that are 10 years old and more just goes to show that there aren't any big secrets in terms of squeezing extra miles per gallon out of these vehicles. It can be done. The issue where the difference between us and, say, Europe is that they don't buy big SUVs, and they don't buy a lot of V8s, and they tend to buy smaller cars because gas is $7-$8 a gallon. And so, you know, the issue really is market demand, and it hasn't been here. I saw surveys even as recent as last year where fuel economy was like eighth or ninth on the list of what people look for in a vehicle, even when gas prices were up over $3 per gallon. So, you know, that's been the difference in the market here is we haven't really demanded that, you know, widely enough yet. And I think that is changing, and I think car companies are starting to respond to it.
I think it's amazing, Dave, that you keep your cars for 10 to 12 years, which is admirable, but you must be so tempted being in this business of writing about cars to get all kinds of cars.
Well, maybe that, you know, being in the business, I get into a lot of those cars. So that, you know, that's the one thing is I do get to drive a lot of these vehicles and get to, you know, enjoy them that way and probably don't feel the need to actually own one myself because I'm constantly in a number of them and get some time in them. So that's the beauty of this job is I do get to experience some pretty nice cars.
Mm-hmm. I think this is Jim. Hi, Jim.
Yes. I'm hoping that we can talk a little more about fuel efficiency. First, when Congress put the standards on cars, on passenger cars, the CAFE standards, but exempted trucks, and then the manufacturers stopped building cars, and I mean, call their cars trucks, SUVs. And where are we at as far as the CAFE standards? But that's what happened. I mean, Congress put the standards on cars, and people didn't want to buy the small cars, so they had the trucks were exempted, so SUVs were trucks.
Right. Yeah, that's been kind of the problem with the policy here is we have sort of a policy that requires these vehicles to be built, but there's because we have low gas prices, it's not encouraging a lot of people to buy them. And you know, there are often loopholes in the CAFE rules that, you know, you're pointing out the big one where we stopped building large cars to a large extent, and we shifted those people into big SUVs. And because we could get because the trucks had lower mileage standards to meet, so you know, the industry has worked around the requirements to some extent, and you know, we're at where we're at because of that. But there are tougher standards coming. They've got a 36 mile per gallon standard that they have to meet for their fleets in 2016. So it's a pretty aggressive target. And what I think you'll see is a lot more downsized engines. We'll be seeing people, you know, buying a V6 instead of a V8 or a four-cylinder instead of a six. We're going to see more turbocharging, lighter weight vehicles. You're seeing many more hybrids and even electric vehicles coming to the market. So the standards are getting tougher again, and they're expected to continue to go up from there.
Thanks so much for the call. Ken from Milwaukee.
Hi.
Hi.
Question regarding alternative fuel vehicles. A very big deal was made about a week and a half ago, regarding one GM plant outside of Baltimore that was being sold or hoped to be sold to, I forgot what company, that was making electric cars. What factor are these companies making in the industry, and what do you see them doing in the future?
Yeah, that's GM's Wilmington plant is going to go to Fisker, and they're going to build hybrids out of that plant. And there are a ton of upstarts now that are building or planning to build either hybrid electric vehicles or full electric vehicles, and you're seeing this. You know, we're at a stage maybe we haven't seen since the beginning of the automobile where it's possible for some of these companies to get into the business and even make it. You know, used to be said that these small company couldn't possibly compete with these giants, but as we change into the electrification of the automobile, it is opening the door to innovation from companies that aren't in the business today. And so you are starting to see it's hard to keep up with all of them. You know, there seems to be a press release every day about some company with an electric vehicle plan. So it's hard to tell who will, you know, if any of them will survive and who might be the winners are. But there definitely is a different dynamic going on in this industry as we switch to electrification. It's almost square one for everybody, and it's opening the door to players we haven't seen before.
It'll be interesting to see how that evolves. Dave, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Oh, great. I had fun.
Good. I'm glad. Dave Zoya, editorial director of WardsAuto.com, Wards Automotive Reports, and Wards Engine and Vehicle Technology Update. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Today is Rob's last day, so if you have a chance, we have this website. You know, we're on Facebook. Wow. And if you go to WPR.org and find Kathleen Dunn, you can send him a message and wish him well as he heads out to the University of Chicago. That's it for this hour. But don't go away. Next hour is going to be fabulous. This is the Ideas Network.